We're running a little bit behind schedule, so I'm going to keep the opening remarks fairly brief. The last panel discussed the low-tech but far better known successes of the Cuban healthcare system: high immunization rates, low infant mortality, a focus on prevention, and cost-effective care. This panel will focus on the high technology but far less well-known story of the aspect of the Cuban story, and that is the strength of their research institutions and the growth of the biotechnology sector. It's a fascinating topic, and we have a terrific panel for you today. To go down the order, you have their bios in your folder, so I will not go through those biographies in depth, but just give you a bit of an introduction. The first speaker will be Simon Reed Henry. Simon is the lecturer of geography at the University of London and the director of the Center for the Study of Global Security and Development. He has a forthcoming book on the nature of Cuba's biotechnology experiment entitled The Cuban Cure, Reason and Resistance in Global Science. The next speaker will be Claire Sansom. Dr. Sansom is a bioinformatics lecturer and freelance science journalist based in Cambridge and London. Her background in training is molecular simulation, and she has spent the better part of her career on simulations of important targets for drugs for cancer and AIDS. She has written for numerous publications, including Lancet Specialist Journals, Nature, Biotechnology, and Chemistry World. Her interests as a journalist include development of bioscience and medicine outside the Western world. The third speaker will be Jean Handy, Dr. Jean Handy. She is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, where she has spent the last 25 years directing the diagnostic laboratories of virology, parasitology, and bacteriology. She has also been working with medical students and research institutions in Cuba since 1993. We're going to try to keep the each of the presentations around 15 minutes so that we can leave some questions at the end from the audience. Without further ado.
Thanks, Doss. So, with apologies for the least high-tech slide of the day, ironically, for the talk, I was asked to cover a number of things, some of which I feel more qualified to talk about than others. Perhaps in questions we can range a little wider. But what I'd like to do in my presentation this afternoon, or this morning, depending on where you've come from, is to focus on the nature of Cuban biotechnology work and to say something about why that might be important. As I am neither a political scientist nor an expert on partnering within the biosciences, I propose to limit my comments on partnering and future directions of Cuban biotech research to just two things, which I think are actually quite easily overlooked in approaching the question of research in Cuba. And they are, first of all, Cuba's scope for genuinely innovative work, and the way that, secondly, such work might be, in fact, valuable. Now, of course, innovation and value are two of the primary preoccupations of the biotechnology industry, certainly in capitalist countries. But the way in which they're connected in what is in Cuba, after all, a state socialist-run country, is rather different, and I think actually is very important. What I particularly want to try and get onto towards the end of the talk, if I get time, then, is to look at the way in which the relationship between those two things, innovation and value, plays out. The way in which, for example, innovation is valued and so nurtured, and the way that value is in turn derived from innovation. I think this is really worth bearing in mind when we think about Cuba. But in order to get a sense of some of the major areas of focus and achievement with respect to biotech research and development, it seems sensible to start with the background to Cuba's whole biotech project, particularly as I'll be speaking first in this panel. So I'll say first of all a few words about that, and then I'll go on to say a little bit about what is and isn't different about biotech research in Cuba before returning to those questions about innovation and value. Now, it's important to discuss some of the specifics of the Cuban approach because, first of all, their approach is often misunderstood, particularly around such issues as intellectual property, and hopefully we'll have a few moments to talk about that. But secondly, thinking about the way their approach is and is not different to the way we may do biotech research here in the US or in the UK. Also helps us to think about other non-Western biotech sectors more generally. And I think this is where the issue of high-tech research and innovation ties in very closely to some of the comments we've already heard about the nature of Cuban medical research more generally and the way in which a public health model is prioritized. So first of all then, let me make a brief comparison with the US experience. Now, for those of you who this is painfully familiar, my apologies, but for those of you for who it's not, it's useful to have a sense of where biotech comes from, because like all industries, it does have a history. And really just to pull out some of the main things from this in terms of the US model, which is in many ways very similar to a broadly Western capitalist model of biotech, are the four things that I've listed there at the bottom, which is the way in which academic research meets venture capital. So the way in which research becomes organized around niche opportunities and the potential for financial reward. Secondly, the blurring of the basic versus applied science distinction. So this is the idea of basic research, it's blue skies thinking, how do we solve a problem like ... as opposed to applied science, which is really much more about finding a particular problem that needs to be solved and doing whatever is required to go about doing that. Thirdly, a flexible regulatory system. New things happen. New things are invented in biotech all the time. That needs to be incorporated into the existing legislative structure of particular countries, and flexibility is obviously very helpful there. And finally, the IPR regime, which provides incentives and guarantees. The IPR regime, to cut a very long story very short, insofar as it shapes the Western biotechnology model, is really based around the standard idea of property and ownership, and the fact that one can, through patenting an invention or an idea or even an actual discovered element of living matter, stake a claim to that and seek reward from that for a certain period of time. These are all key features to the US model. So what's different then about the Cuban approach? The first thing to say is that the Cuban approach developed not really very much after approaches to biotech in the West. Okay, so really we're looking at the late 70s, early 80s in the West when we start to think about a biotechnology industry emerging as such, and it's the same time in Cuba. And there'll be some people talking on a little bit later on about how this fitted into Castro's particular vision at the time, that he wanted to make Cuba a world medical power. I will leave that for them. But there is a common narrative which I just want to dispel, first of all. And the idea is common to Cuba and also to other poor countries, and it's that when they do high-tech science, like biotech, they tend to do it through reverse engineering, first of all. So you take a product that's been developed in the West, you take it apart, this is obviously a little bit more complex than it sounds, and you figure out how it's done, and then you build up the technology platform from that basis. So essentially it's learning through copying. And there is a sense that this is not necessarily that innovative, and it's not necessarily playing by the rules of the game. But of course, when we talk about intellectual property rights, and this is why I mentioned the American case first of all, we have to understand that while there is a global regulatory regime, these property rights are specific to different countries. So countries will buy into a particular system, the WTO, for example, or the TRIPS, the GATT TRIPS Accord, which of course this year is going to become very interesting when that when the period of time that developing world countries were given to catch up to speed with the West, if you like, comes to a close. But they're very specific and they're very country-based. And so it's not necessarily that obvious to presume that one country should follow a particular model. And the idea, certainly when it comes to Cuba, is that the way that the Cubans first developed biotech was by reverse engineering a product which was in the early 1980s very popular and considered by many to be sort of the next drug to beat cancer, if you like, and that was interferon. And so there is a common sense, and it's actually often repeated in Cuba as well, that the Cubans began working on interferon, reverse engineered that, built up a research platform to fit, and then gradually broke off into different areas of research. And that's actually not quite the case. I haven't got time to go through any of these in detail again, but hopefully you'll have had a chance to glance now that there were actually a series of other push factors that lay behind the development of the Cuban biotechnology sector in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and which continue to shape it today. And just the most important of those that I will point out is the way in which taking down the bottom here, the health system and the education system really come together in biotech. So you can think of biotech as existing, if you like, at the apex of those two things. because you need very well-trained individuals, intelligent individuals, and individuals familiar with the latest technologies to do biotech. But you also need to have that familiarity organized around a health system. And that is one of the things that Cuba had, which I guess you could talk of as being a sort of natural, although of course it's a socially produced natural resource, in abundance in that period. There are other things here which actually make the Cubans' experience more specific, but I won't complicate things too much. But moving on, just a little then, what did that then result in? What sort of biotech sector emerged from those driving factors? Just some of the main things which people often talk about, and it's worth perhaps knowing something of, are first of all the emergence of the biological front. We've talked before about how the captain, this is Castro, has sort of steered his ship at different times and producing something like the biological front, which is really a kind of souped-up think tank or sort of government agency, which was able to direct and control the early work of the biotechnology scientists and institutes in Cuba, was a key part of that. The real breakthrough moment, though, came in 1986 with the founding of the CIGB, the Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology in Havana. And this is really, at the time, was really, you know, way ahead of the game, certainly in terms of the developing world. But it's been the sort of the linchpin institute in Cuban biotech research since then. But it exists as part of a wider science pole. And just to say a couple of things here, the idea of a science park, which is very common in the West, an agglomeration of organizations in a particular technology field working around a certain idea, be that, for example, computer chips or be it biotech research, is very common. But really what a science park involves is lots of similar organizations working alongside one another, benefiting from economies of scale, for example, but often working in competition with one another. And it's the reason that shops of the same sort set up alongside one another on a high street. The science pole is different because it involves a greater degree of organisation and coordination from the top. And this makes it really rather unique. It's also, I think, been one of the key reasons why the biotechnology institutes within the science pole, which constitutes around 14,000 researchers, have been able to collaborate, and this will be a key theme of my talk, to a much greater degree than have many other examples. But these first three examples are from the 1980s, of course, and this is when Cuba was still a part of the Comecon countries, and it was still very much bound into and receiving financial aid from the Soviet Union. That changed in the 89 to 91 period, of course, when the Soviet Union collapsed and Cuba found it had no financial resources to rely upon coming from those countries. So it was, as has been mentioned already, going through its own sort of credit crunch. The fact that it was able to sustain at least the basic element of its biotechnology platforms and to focus and clarify some of its research initiatives is testimony, I think, to the idea that Cuba is able to survive those sorts of difficulties. And that is worth thinking about as we move forward into the next decade and thinking of sustainability in the future. But really, I think, while I wouldn't want to say that the research has been undermined since the early 1990s, it has in some ways, and this is a loaded term which I should perhaps be careful of, but it has in some ways stagnated. What the Cubans have done is outsource some of their technology platforms in order to recoup the funding that's required to keep it going. But at the same time, they focused in on certain areas of competitive advantage, which makes sense. And so they've developed an expertise, particularly in cancer vaccines. They've focused on some of their earlier breakthrough products, such as the meningitis B vaccine, and finding ways of marketing those to new countries. And while they have, at the same time, continued with this idea of quite regularly giving away large quantities of their biomedical products to countries in need to support the medical diplomacy system that they have, they have, of course, had to find ways of engaging with a Western capitalist biotechnology economy. And this is where the story starts to become rather more interesting. This, by the way, just to give you a sense of... I'm just going to give you a couple of slides now that will backtrack over what I've been saying. This is the CIGB, the sort of the flagship institution, as it's regularly called, in Cuba. This was it being built. And this is a second slide taken from a Cuban presentation, actually, which just gives you a sense of the development of the basic research space in Cuba in that period of the 1980s. But this is where we're at today, and there are elements of these key features which I would want to stress are partly a product of where Cuban biotech has come from, this public health-driven model, and they're also partly a product today of the way it's engaged already in a broader Western biopharmaceutical economy. So I'll try to say just a few comments about this now. How are we doing for time, Tom? Doing good. If we are to look for defining features of Cuban biotech research, then I think we look first of all to the health system. And so a lot of the comments that we've heard already today about the way in which that health system is organized feed through into the biotech sector. Now, that's actually rather unexpected, because the biotech sector in Western countries is certainly not organized that way around. It's organized around finding profitable products, and it's organized around securing funding in order to maintain a pipeline stream. But in Cuba, we have a number of very different features, and some of these have already been mentioned. The integration between upstream and downstream processes, for example. So a large center such as the CIGB, which you've just seen, will engage not only in basic research, but it will also channel that research through into applied project lines, and it will follow those project lines through into the very final stages of clinical development, which, of course, in biotech products is crucial. You can create a product that works well in the lab, but you then have to make that product work in the world. And the way you do that is to put it through an often rather lengthy process of clinical trials. Now, this is where the Cuban integration between biomedical science and the health system can actually be rather useful. Because with the fantastic coverage that the Cuban health system provides, it becomes very easy to integrate a clinical trial process into that health system. It becomes much easier to register between different trial populations and to record information from those, and so to actually speed up the whole process of eventual drug delivery into the bodies of individual people. And that's a really key feature of it. Another key feature is the idea of centralization versus flexibility, the idea that there may be a particular initiative. We've heard about work on generic antiretroviral drugs, for example. That directive can be issued, but the way in which that directive might then be researched and the goal, if you like, met, is actually open to a surprising degree of flexibility. And the individual institutes within the science pole, of which there are around 40 or so, will either variously collaborate or develop their own particular approaches to that product and come back to a sort of central organisational body. The biological front, which I mentioned earlier, no longer exists, but there is still a coordinating body in the science pole. And that body will then not only think about which is the best way to pursue those research aims, but it also has control over the financing. So in effect, it's able to say, well, this institute is doing the better work. We will therefore channel more of the funds to there, rather than what often happens in the West, which is that a company claims it's doing the best work, it attracts the money, and in actual fact, that money goes away from where the best work was being done. The idea of social determinants of health driving particular project developments is a crucial one as well. If you looked at Cuban's biotechnology pipeline, you will not see, or you see it will differ quite substantially to that of the United States or the United Kingdoms, for example. There's a much greater focus on meeting, first of all, domestic national health issues. So hence you will see, for example, recombinant products such as streptokinase, which are used in lowering blood cholesterol, because that is a health issue in Cuba. But you won't see a lot of the sort of designer drugs that absorb so many of those tax dollars and investment dollars in the US. Now, this is all really rather unusual. And the tendency, I think, for people to take this on and think, well, you know, therefore, are they doing something particularly remarkable in Cuba? Is their approach to research different? Are they working under a much more authoritarian scientific approach? You know, people often throw around the idea of Lyshenkoism, which in the Soviet Union was really it amounted to the denial of the gene, and that shaped research programs in the Soviet Union. You don't get that in Cuba, but what you do get is this combination between hierarchical decision making, which is able to identify key needs at the population level, and local flexible delivery of the products which will then meet those health needs. So this is why I say we need to think not just about where Cuban biotech has come from in the 80s, but also since the early 1990s, how it's been engaging with other Western both companies and regulatory systems. So, for example, in the mid-1990s, Cuba did sign up to the TRIPS Accord, and it's gradually developed its intellectual property regulation to become in line with the West. At the same time, it's also engaged in partnering with primarily and initially non-Western pharmaceutical outfits, so it's got a lot of engagements in China. It has a lot of engagements in India as well, having recently signed a deal with Biocon, which is one of the largest Indian biotech companies. And gradually, those collaborations and partnering experiences are sort of working their way through to Western European and American markets. But it's a slow process, and the reason it's a slow process is because, in addition to these problems of a developing country biotech experience trying to break into Western markets, which is always a problem, you have, of course, the embargo. And the embargo and its impact on high-tech research is worth just saying a couple of short things about. First of all, and perhaps unexpectedly, the embargo has in some ways helped Cuban biotech research, because for a long time it's enabled, certainly in the crucial period of the 80s I spoke about earlier, it enabled the Cubans to not worry about following Western intellectual property rules. Because you can't quite simply, if you are already hitting someone with the stick of the embargo, which is a form of economic regulation or over-regulation, you can't at the same time entice them with the carrot of selling those products in Western markets, because they wouldn't be able to anyway. And so this gave the Cubans a sort of window of opportunity, if you like, in which to develop their particular approach. But that said, they have been trying to orient their procedures to Western norms. This is not as easy as it sounds. It's not just as easy as having the idea of thinking it would be nice to now align ourselves with the standards of the West and everything will carry on the same. Because when you start buying into patenting structures, when you start organizing your research practices around international norms, which have been set up to work initially according to the way it works in the West, you have to physically restructure a lot of things. And this has been a real problem for the biotech sector in Cuba. It's one I think they've been addressing, but it continues to complicate the issue. So this then is where we're at today, the idea of what I would certainly argue are certain defining features in biotech research in Cuba, features that emerged in the 1980s, were reshaped in the 1990s, and which are today playing out in hopefully productive ways. Certainly there are the opportunities there, but there are these existing problems of principally the embargo, but also the extent to which Western nations will, for example, accept trials that have already been carried out in Cuba. There are sort of sometimes cultural stereotypes around the idea that some countries are not able to do clinical trials as well as we may be able to in the West. And these cultural stereotypes within the industry are as much a problem in some ways as the geopolitical problems of the embargo. So those two things notwithstanding, there's plenty of opportunity, but there's also certainly a lot of scope for further collaboration and discussion on both sides. So I'll leave my comments there. I think I've probably already overrun. But thank you very much.
Firstly, can you all hear me? Adjust the microphone for my small size. and before I started, I'd like to thank the organisers very much for inviting me to what is a fascinating meeting. And this talk is going to be a little different in that I'm not going to take the general overview that you've just heard from Simon. In fact, I think it's rarely good that these two presentations should go next to each other, because what I'm going to do is focus in on one particular success story in Cuban biotech that I know of more about than any other aspect of the work in the country, and that is looking at cancer immunotherapy. And now, how should I? Yes. Just, and to explain where I come from, will, I hope, also explain why I've picked this particular example. I've probably got fewer Cuban credentials, as it were, than anyone else on the distinguished panels today. I started off life simply as a researcher, as a postdoc for many years, looking mostly at using bioinformatics and molecular modelling in drug design. My research interests, such as they are now, include molecular immunology, but I'm mainly a teacher and also a science journalist. And when the research group that I'm loosely connected to at Birkbeck College in London was asked to send one delegate to a cancer immunotherapy meeting in Havana in November 2006, I jumped at the chance. As a writer, and as a scientist, I've been interested in the development of science and biomedicine in emerging economic areas, and I thought it gave me an excellent opportunity to stay on after the meeting and to do some research as a feature writer for The Lancet. So I published a couple of pieces in The Lancet Oncology on cancer in Cuba and also in The Lancet Infectious Diseases. And it was through my work, my research for The Lancet Oncology mainly, that I discovered about Cuba's extraordinary developments, given their resources, in the field of cancer immunotherapy. So I will take you in the next 12 minutes or so through this case study, looking at immunology and immunotherapy in Cuba and the development of therapeutic antibodies and cancer vaccines, and how these have been and are being trialled and brought into the market, not only in Cuba, but throughout the rest of the world. And the work that I'm going to be talking about is mainly done in this institute here, the Center of Molecular Immunology, or to use the Spanish acronym CIM, in Havana, which is part of, as Simon mentioned, the Science Pole. It's a prestigious research institute. You can see that a state-of-the-art looking building established in 1994. This research priority has built on decades of investment in immunology, which I guess is driven by the priorities that were so excellently discussed in the first session, in very, very much focusing on public health. And you've heard before just how much progress Cuba has made in vaccination programs, and this is just some of the statistics, a partial list in order to get them on the slide, based on that you've seen before, starting with the elimination of the poliomyelitis back in 1962, and some of the more recent vaccines. And you've heard before that the Cuban vaccination program is considered exemplary. Cuba achieves this largely through having its own indigenous vaccine production, and this has led to an enormous research focus on immunology, which now goes way beyond the traditional vaccines for infectious diseases, and to a feature on using immunology and immunotherapy in the control and treatment of cancer. and I'll be talking about some of the products that have been and are being developed at CIM, starting with the anti-EGFR monoclonal antibody nimutuzumab, and which is now in clinical use in Cuba and in advanced clinical trials in many other countries for the treatment of cancer, and talk also about some cancer vaccines. So, just to sum up some of the problems that the embargo has caused and is still causing this of development from, I've just included a couple of quotes here that appeared in my article in The Lancet Oncology from Augustine Large, who's the director of CIM. And these quotes were given in interviews at the end of 2006, but I don't think that the actual practical position on the ground has changed very much. I mean, the first concerns the acquisition of consumables in Cuba, and since they're not allowed to buy any products from the United States, they have had a continuing problem in recent years with the acquisition of companies that used to provide them with most of their consumables and were based in Europe or in Canada by US conglomerates. So the Pharmacia and Amersham have become part of Pfizer and GE Healthcare, which to most countries in the world, it doesn't really matter. You buy your consumables from one company or another. Since these two companies are US-based, however, the products in their catalogues are now inaccessible in Cuba. And the other quote concerns the bureaucratic difficulties of getting drugs produced in Cuba used in the clinic in the United States, not only in clinical trials, but also in what's called compassionate use programs. So, just, I don't know how much biotech background anyone in this audience has, but to anyone who knows how and of what EGFR is and what antibodies, how antibodies against EGFR work, I mean, this is simply a protein epidermal growth factor receptor that is overexpressed by cancer cells. It is expressed actually by many other cell types in the body. And monoclonal antibodies directed against this receptor that bind to it and prevent it working have been proved to be very effective against certain types of cancer. And this program started in the 1980s when many Western countries were also looking at this, both in academic labs and then very soon afterwards in the biotech industry. Western biotechs have enormous resources for clinical development, and the drugs developed simultaneously in the West are now in very wide use. A couple of the most important ones, cetuximab, marketed as Erbitux, erlotinib, marketed as Tarceva, and the clinicians in the audience will almost certainly have come across their use. So, is this a potential blockbuster? Well, these two drugs in particular are in the magic class of molecule that have the name blockbuster because they earn for their developers over $1 billion a year. And I mean, this is not necessarily just sort of profit, all profit for those companies, because in the West it can cost $1 billion to put a drug on the market. So in a certain sense, they're recouping in a year what they spent on developing the drug. Nimutuzumab is developed at CIM is a molecule of similar type, licensed now into individual developing countries from Cuba, and that it is being developed in the West through external companies. There are particular difficulties with its use in the US, the need to go through OFAC to agree compassionate use at all clinical trials. So the first clinical trials for pediatric glioma post-date trials in all other countries. So it was in use in trials, at least, in Europe and in the Far East much earlier than in the United States. Currently, there are 16 trials of this drug registered on the worldwide website clinicaltrials.gov and in various different phases with four trials in the most advanced phase three where the drug is given to very large numbers of patients and is trialed against the best current regimes. And that shows that they're in Europe, Canada, and the US through the company YM Biosciences, which is based in cancer in Canada, and a number of institutes in Asia, particularly China, also Singapore. And just shows you where they've got to. And I know there are a number of dermatologists in the audience. Well, it illustrates some of the side effects that are common to these drugs, with a very serious rash, which irritatingly has been correlated with good anti-tumour response. So it seems the worse rash you get with some of the other EGFR inhibitors, the more likely your tumour is to respond. Nimetuzumab, however, differs from all these drugs in not causing this particular unpleasant side effect. It's not very much more better at treating cancer, but the patients treated with it seem to have a better quality of life. So similar efficacy, reduced side effects. This gives the drug a potential for being best in class, not first in class, but to actually be preferred for the same indication if it can be licensed. And people have studied the reasons for this. It's believed paradoxically to be partly because its affinity to the receptor is lower. All cells produce this receptor, and inhibiting it in normal cells can produce side effects. This rather gentler acting drug will simply zoom in on those cells that produce most of it, which are the tumour cells. And just to go on in the last few minutes to discuss a few other products, the cancer vaccines, the Simovax is the most advanced cancer vaccine. Just to explain quickly what a cancer vaccine is. It is a drug that is designed to stimulate the human immune system to treat cancer cells as foreign bodies and to attack them. This is also a vaccine that takes the epidermal growth factor receptor, EGFR, as its target and will induce the human immune system to target cells that overexpress it. It was the first cancer vaccine licensed anywhere in the world, but is licensed only in Cuba against the very difficult to treat non-small cell lung cancer. And just to illustrate one particular trial result of a randomized phase two study in advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and it was found to increase the patient's life expectancy particularly and most statistically significantly in patients under the age of 60. And just one more similar type of approach, these gangliosides. You don't need to know what a glycosphingolipid is. Don't worry about it. Molecules expressed on the surface of cells and often particularly of cancer cells. Different molecules of this type are characteristic of different organisms and different cell types. This particular one is found in normal cells, interestingly, in all mammals except humans. We've knocked out the gene that produces it, but interestingly, it is found on cancer cells. Therefore, this is considered to be an extremely promising target for a cancer vaccine, because if the vaccine targets cells that express this particular molecule, it will be only targeting the cancer cells. So again, you should get few side effects. And a vaccine targeted to this molecule should really be exquisitely specific to human tumour cells, and CIM have developed one of these. Clinical trial results in Cuba have been very promising, but here you run against one of the problems that was introduced by the last speaker, in that other countries find not really able, for regulatory bodies, will not accept a clinical trial that's been done in Cuba as fulfilling their exacting requirements. So you will have to trial this drug using in other markets in order to get it accepted on the market by organisations such as EMEA in Europe, never mind FDA in the States, with the embargo as another problem. And to aid the development of these vaccines, it's useful to have a mouse model. Mice, as I mentioned on the previous slide, are not a particularly good model for this, because they actually express it. So if you targeted a mouse cancer with this vaccine, you'd land up giving the poor mouse horrible side effects, because the gangliocyte is found on normal mouse cells. So the obvious thing to do in the biotech industry, create a knockout mouse that does not express this drug. And that is what they have done twice over. Once in a group led by Ajit Varki in San Diego, but they can't export it to Cuba. So a UK company, Systems Biology Limited, have simply replicated this, which is actually quite sort of altruistic of them, because they can't publish it. The San Diego group have this mouse. The UK company cannot publish something that's already been done. They've simply created it for export to Cuba. And just to say that these mice are perfectly normal mice. So just to sum up, I'm sorry if I've overrun by a few minutes. What are the prospects? Well, one of my collaborators from Systems Biology Limited, the company that produced the mice, says there is a lot of hope for change, in particular in the Cuban biotech industry, is what she was intending. But the wheels are turning very, very slowly. There have been changes since the start of the Obama administration, certainly, but they've really been changes in atmosphere rather than changes in policy. And a Senate report in February 2009 recommended an increase in medical trade and in research collaboration between the US and Cuba, and which I hope that this will lead to a diminution in some of the project problems that Professor Large have highlighted in 2006, and who knows, maybe the next important transgenic mouse to be created in a California lab will be able to be directly exported to Cuba. And that's just a quote, which I won't read in the interests of time, from that Senate report that suggests that a normalization of the relationship between the US and Cuba to maybe the same level as other countries that it has certain disagreements with, but treats as part of a perfectly valid part of the international community, would help to the development, and I would say particularly in the biotech industry. And the US itself has very much to gain from collaboration with world-class researchers and in cancer immunotherapy, and people who have done this world-class research with remarkably few resources. And a few acknowledgements. And thank you very much.
Well, good morning, and first I want to thank Catherine and the organizers for putting together this excellent program. I am going to, I think we've gone in a really good order here because we've been focusing on the overview and then some specific examples of some high-tech biotechnology research. And I am just one individual researcher, U.S.-based at a university, and I have some experiences in forging some research partnerships that have endured since 1993 to the present, and I'm just going to share with you my personal experiences. I think it may be significant that fully half of the panelists for this excellent program are recruited from our neighbors from Canada and from the UK, and that has something to do with the difficulties that attend any sort of partnership of this nature for a U.S.-based person, but I have been very fortunate to be able to carry this forward over the years. And in preparing this talk, I thought about what I consider to be some of the key elements to forming any sort of a large or small partnership to do any sort of meaningful research. And first, I thought of just simply the access to information about what is going on in Cuba, areas of research they are interested in, what kinds of things are they publishing. And in terms, what I'm going to do is just show you a few images that illustrate a few of these first key points, and then I'm going to depart from the slides and just tell you how it developed for me. This is an image, speaking of access, that I made in 1996 in our health sciences library, and I've used it in presentations to our medical and graduate students and different folks. And it just shows the termination of access that occurred in 1959. This is an old medical journal, a cancer journal from Havana, that our library used to subscribe to, and you can see the dates on there going through the 1940s, and the last volume on the shelf before the bookend there is the 1959 volume, and that was the end of it. And when I undertook this project, that was about the state of it. I knew absolutely nothing about what was going on in biomedical science in Cuba. I had taken an active interest in some of the U.S. policy issues throughout Central America during the decade of the 80s. And I had approached those issues through biomedicine because that was what I knew. I was directing a diagnostic laboratory in virology at the hospitals of the University of North Carolina Medical School. And so I was very interested in events in Nicaragua and Guatemala, El Salvador. And I was on some mailing lists of some organizations. So in 1993, I got a mailing from a group that said Cuba is undergoing tremendous shortages because of the fall of the Soviet bloc. There are food shortages and fuel shortages and many difficulties, and now there has been a big storm, and can you help? So that was my invitation. I wasn't going out and looking for Cuban biomedical materials. If I had, I would not have found what is on this next slide, but this is a screenshot that I took last week from our same health sciences library. And this is the main journal that is published by the Tropical Medicine Institute where my collaborations are based. It is now freely available, the full text online, and we can access it anytime we want to. And so things have become much, much easier in terms of just access to the information that is being published. However, at the time that I got involved in this endeavor, that wouldn't have done me any good anyway, because my Spanish at that point was minimal, to put it charitably. And I would not have been able to read these publications in Spanish. And for that reason, I really want to call attention to what Dr. Keck has briefly mentioned already. Medic Review, I think, is a tremendous resource for anybody in this country who is interested in learning about Cuban biomedicine in general, specific people and activities in particular, their philosophical approach to these things, and just a means of dissemination of what is going on out there and what information is available. This is, I believe you're right in stating, it is the only English language publication that addresses these issues with publications by the Cuban scientists themselves. And through a journal of that sort, or through whatever means one comes to this endeavor, the next step is that you have to identify what your common interests are. Find someone. It's like any research collaboration. If you're going to collaborate with someone, you need something that both of you are working on, know something about, and are interested in. In my own case, the director of the virology laboratory at IPK is Dra. Guadalupe Guzman, whose specialty is the area of dengue virus. And she wrote an article that appeared in Science a few years ago, just outlining her experiences in her research career, and as well as the Cuban approach to dengue virus and the work that they have done. She directs the virology laboratory at the IPK, and I think it's already been mentioned that IPK is a national reference laboratory that does not only reference diagnostic work, but also research work in all the areas of microbiology, viruses, bacteria, mycobacteria, fungi, especially parasites. It was founded by a famous parasitologist back in the 1930s. And the staff at the IPK has tremendous global experience. There are a number of people there who have trained or practiced or both in Africa and who are familiar with a number of parasitic and viral diseases that are not seen in Cuba. So there are many areas of common interest if you can identify those. My particular collaborator is Dr. Pedro Maslago, who specializes, he is a member of the virology laboratory and is a specialist in the area of poliovirus. And back, Dr. Mas is a physician who was one of the half or so of the physicians existing in Cuba. He was a young doctor at the time of the revolution, and he was one of those who chose to stay rather than to leave. He is a tremendously idealistic individual. He has seen the practice of medicine in Cuba as it existed before the revolution and has participated in all of the developments since then. In the early 1960s, during the Russian period, as we have discussed, Dr. Mas visited Moscow and also spent time in Bulgaria learning methods for working with the poliovirus and the production and use of the trivalent oral polio vaccine. And he participated in a major way in the design of the early polio vaccine campaigns that, it has already been mentioned a couple times, they eradicated polio on their island by 1962. Dr. Mas has chronicled some of this history in some PAHO-sponsored publications and is immensely proud of it. And because of the special characteristics of Cuba being an island with a very, very organized annual campaign of polio vaccination, there are some special conditions that exist there that enabled Dr. Mas to participate in this CDC-sponsored trial of the use of inactivated polio vaccine. Those of you who follow the issues here are probably aware that there is a trend now towards saying, well, once we have eradicated polio from the world, then the oral polio vaccine has some drawbacks because it occasionally will revert and cause paralytic polio, and we need to investigate whether we can go back to the use of the inactivated vaccine to make sure that we maintain control once we no longer have wild virus circulating. In terms of facilitating these kinds of collaborative work, such as this rather ambitious trial that was conducted with the scientists at the CDC, the Pan American Health Organization and the WHO have played really key critical roles, especially in terms of collaboration involving scientists in the United States, and most particularly scientists who may be working for the United States government, as the CDC people are, because, as we've said many times, there are no really direct relationships that are intergovernmental in that standpoint. But when an event or a trial or an opportunity for communication is sponsored by the PAHO, for example, it kind of is a way of circumventing some of the political aspects of the situation and creating opportunities for collaborative efforts. So with that, I'm going to leave the images and just depart from, this is the last slide, I'm just going to leave it up there with my areas and talk just a little bit about the development of how my collaboration worked for me. As I said, the access was facilitated by a very fortuitous event. I got this thing in the mail, and it said, if you might be able to help, call this number in New York. So I called up, and I spoke with a woman by the name of Mary Murray, who now lives in Havana. She is the Havana bureau chief for NBC right now, but at the time she was working for a group called U.S.-Cuba Medical Project, and they were based in New York. And Mary told me on the telephone something that had not appeared anywhere in the literature yet. She said, yes, they're having a lot of trouble with nutritional limitations. This was the beginning, the really worst years of the so-called, what is now referred to as the special period. She said they have all these limitations of nutrition and transportation and every other possible thing, plus they've had some big storms. And there is this epidemic of eye disease. And have you heard about that? I said, no, I don't know anything about it. She said, well, there are some virologists in Cuba that have isolated some enteroviruses. Now, that's the group of human viruses that are very closely related to the poliovirus, and that's all you need to know about it. I'm not going to go into the virology in this talk. But she said they've isolated these enteroviruses from cerebrospinal fluid of many of these patients. And did you say you were a virologist? And I said, well, yes, I'm a virologist, but I never heard of an enterovirus causing anything like this. I don't know anything about optic neuropathy. And she said, fine, you're the virologist for our delegation. I said, well, all right. So that was my first opportunity to go to Cuba. But Mary didn't just sort of take us on a tour and say, okay, this is the IPK and this is the CIGB. She took me to the IPK and introduced me to Dr. Maas, who was the director of the enterovirus laboratory. And he was my direct colleague with whom I could talk, and that experience changed the course of my entire career since then, because it was phenomenal to me, the degree of openness and confidence and sharing. Dr. Maas didn't know me from anybody, and I walked in the lab. He said, here's what we've been doing. Here's this weird virus. I don't know what to do with it, where to go next. We don't have resources to really do the basic research on it. Here are my laboratory notebooks. Here's what we've been doing. We talked about the virology of it, and I learned that one of probably the very best ways of learning any kind of a foreign language is to work on something that both participants know the substance of and have a little smattering of each other's language. You learn the language very rapidly, and we did that. And so I said, well, I want to follow up, and what can I do? So I decided I wanted to invite Dr. Maas to give a presentation on his findings at the next meeting of the American Society for Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, which was held some 4 months from then in Atlanta. And so I asked before I left Cuba. At the time, you remember, we didn't have email like we do now. I can email my colleagues in Cuba every day now. It's not a problem. Back then, we didn't have email. We couldn't even send a fax directly to Cuba. And my Cuban friends told me the way that I could stay in touch was that there was a company in Canada run by Cubans. It was called Rapitel. And it was in the business of retransmitting faxes from Americans who needed to communicate with someone in Cuba. So for the first several years that we built this collaboration, the way that we had of staying in touch was that I had an account with Rapitel. I would send them a check from time to time. I would send them a fax with a cover sheet that said, please transmit this fax to this number, and they would do so. And I would get a fax in return. So by this means, Dr. Maas came to Atlanta. There were many glitches along that road that I don't really have time to go into, but he gave a presentation on his work. Subsequently, I invited a young investigator from IPK to spend some time in our laboratory assessing what our common interests were. And the first person they sent was a generalist who was very, very good at interpersonal communication, and we figured out the experiences that we had in common. And then we got into some of the logistics and the funding that are terribly important in terms of carrying out anything like this. And those last two areas are really in the state of constant flux. Logistics have become easier. They have become harder. There were a number of years when I was able to organize a group of anywhere from 1 to 5 medical students every summer and send them to Cuba to participate in laboratory research, in hospital rounds, in visiting and spending time with family doctors in their practice, whatever their area of interest was. And I can no longer do that because the rules in the United States changed in 2004, as has already been explained with regard to medic-sponsored programs. We also were able to bring young Cuban investigators to spend periods of anywhere from 2 to 6 months in our laboratory. We've had 5 or 6 such visits. Now, our laboratory and our actual science research is funded by the NIH, but you just try asking the NIH to buy an air ticket for a Cuban to come spend time in Chapel Hill and pay their living expenses. So we have had funding from a variety of sources, most of which are no longer in existence. But the very first thing we did was the Latin American Studies Association had a program of working groups, and I believe we were the very last working group on Cuba to be funded through that. Wayne Smith had an instrumental role in helping us get funding, and that was crucial because what I did was I took 2 of my colleagues to Cuba, introduced them to their respective counterparts. We built our group around HIV and AIDS because that comprises a number of common interests that can be ways to approach not only that virus but also the associated agents that cause opportunistic infections in patients with HIV. And after taking my 2 colleagues to Cuba and they had met some colleagues there, then we had a couple of smaller delegations of young scientists from Cuba that came and spent some time in our laboratories. And we ran into some of the usual issues, too. Like, one of them was a mycologist, and he wanted some assay powders, which the drug companies make and routinely distribute for free to laboratorians in this country in order to test the susceptibility of a fungus to an antifungal agent. And my mycologist colleague called up a company and asked for some assay powders, and then my heart was in my mouth because my colleague just sort of naively said, "We have a guest from Cuba here, and he would like to..." And they were being very, very accommodating until he said that, and then people are just terrified of the repercussions that might happen to them, and they clammed up, and we never got our assay powders. But anyway, we then had a group that was called the Cuba Working Group through an on-campus group that is called the Institute for Study of the Americas, and I was able to invite several of my colleagues as speakers for that, and which covered their air tickets, and then we had to find ways of covering their living expenses. And the SSRC had some funding for a while through the MacArthur and the Ford Foundation that we were very fortunate in being able to have them sponsor some of our projects. But these are areas that one just has to go out there, and the reason I've put persistence in boldface at the end is that this really did change the whole approach to everything I did. It's not something you can easily just delegate and have your secretary just call somebody, because you might have to just spend half the day on the phone getting a hold of whoever it is that you need to get a hold of. And it's something that if you decide you're going to do it, it's a tremendously rewarding endeavor. It can be done, and I just want to close with the remark that full-time research is one of the few remaining avenues that is still entirely and perfectly legal for a professional from this country to go and spend time in Cuba. And I recommend it highly. It's been very enriching. Thank you.
We're running a little short on time, but I think we can have 5 or 10 minutes of questions from the audience. you just raise your hand and we'll call, and if you could just keep your questions short, please. If there isn't, I'll start with one, which is there was a comment around different models of innovation in Cuba. And as you know, around biotech in the U.S., typically the most typical model is U.S. funding for basic research, to build under U.S. law to commercialize and patent that research, the combination of venture capital and medical research institutions to perform the clinical development on that research, and then patent rights or property rights at the end to ensure the ability to exclude imitators and earn a return that moves that forward. You mentioned in the early stages, this is for both Claire and Simon, you mentioned the early stages that Cuba operated by a different model, but that there are a number of different innovative products in the pipeline. You mentioned two, and that there was licensing going on with other entities that were running clinical trials. And I wonder whether or not those, that the intellectual property underlying those products are now patented, and what is the future for the Cuban innovation model, whether or not it'll start to look a little bit more like you see in Western countries.
Hmm. In terms of the products, Claire, you may have a more up-to-date sense of that on me. In terms of the innovation model, I mean, this is an interesting one because it's not that Cubans never had patents. And I think that's often one thing that's misunderstood. They did have patents. They had a patent office which was established in the late 1970s and which was rejigged when they started embarking on biotech in a much more, you know, concerted manner. The understanding of the property which is encoded in a patent might be different in Cuba, in the sense that in a Western country, you will generally, outside of the university regents model, whereby a sort of, you know, you have a sort of collective ownership, essentially property is the right of the individual to bear. Whereas, of course, in Cuba, property is written into the state, in the sense that you, as the scientific inventor, and this I think still applies in terms of the latest innovations. You, as the inventor of that product, the scientist who's discovered it or developed the technology, have a right to be associated with the invention, so you can talk about it at conferences, you can promote it, and so forth. But the financial proceeds from the patent that may accrue will go through to a state central cash till, if you like, and then the state will then oversee where those proceeds go. So what you get is not a sort of individualization or vascularization of the profits from the biotech industry. You actually get those being recycled back in. And that's why, in some ways, it may be an aid to sustainability in a time of tight finances, because it will enable the Cubans to focus on particular projects rather than others. Yeah. Now, in terms of the individual products that might be coming through from that, I'm sure Claire will have more sense. But that's where it comes from.
I must confess, I'm not completely up to date with patents. But as far as I know, that is correct. That the IP of the drugs and the vaccines being developed at CIM is CIM's, and that the money that it generates is being funded back, is being climbed back into those institutes for use in the development of the next generation of drugs and vaccines. It's very much a university public sector led model. And whilst in the whole of the developing world, that model will apply up to preclinical development, but no university, not even the best funded NIH institute in this country, will be able to afford what it takes to take a molecule through clinical trials, for instance. Of course, the fact that, as several people have mentioned, Cuba is a relatively small and closed community, and a community with an enormous amount of the communitarianism, if you will, where people very much see themselves as in the community first, even before they're individuals, and that all those factors make it easier and therefore a lot cheaper to run clinical trials. So it is actually possible, I think, for that model to be used to patent a model into clinical use in Cuba, but it could not possibly apply to developing and marketing it worldwide.
Do you think the low cost of clinical trials will persist as Cuba moves to a good clinical practice system if they're looking to license these products abroad?
I mean, that is what I don't know much about good clinical practice, but certainly the new facility that's being developed at CIM is deliberately going to be made for the first time in Cuba to fulfill all the international GMP rules to allow the products to be simply developed and manufactured jumping through all the hoops necessary to get them in. sorry. Is this better? Yes. Was I audible at all before? Do I need to repeat anything?
Sir?
One knows, one hears about a great deal of commercial interest of various sorts between China and Cuba. Mm-hmm. Is there a corresponding route of interaction in this field?
The only thing I know specifically is that very many of the clinical trials of the monoclonal antibody that I was talking about are being carried out in China and in the wider Far East through collaboration with a Chinese company. And I think that's something that they're looking to expand and to extend.
Yeah, I that's right. There are collaborations, and they do take place. In terms of the scale of them, it's always tempting with China to presume things are on a huge scale. But one needs to bear in mind that Cuban biotech, in terms of annual turnover, it's hard to get concrete information. One should say Ernst & Young did a sort of report in 2005, I think, which is sort of often floated around. That was a figure of 300 million in terms of annual turnover. So one has to bear in mind one's talking on a smaller scale here, but in a way, that makes some of the other things more remarkable. But just to go back also to the prior point, in terms of clinical trials and so forth, in 2006, they also set up what's called a National Cancer Unit, which is specifically designed to oversee, if you like, the organisation of clinical trials that are coming from the Centre for Molecular Immunology that Claire was talking about, in such a way as to actively incorporate that into the public health system that we heard our panellists talking about this morning. So there are ways in which they are trying to safeguard and to streamline, if that's the right word, the processes that they have to date, and that will serve well, I think, in the future.
We have time for.
If I can, could I just make one comment on the China connection? Again, it's I think typically Cuban response to this in that what they've set up in the last 2 years is that there is a campus which is built 30 miles out of Havana, which was the building that held the Latin American Olympics at some point. And there are now 5,000 Chinese science graduates there studying their postdoc in Cuba, learning Spanish. And, of course, in the typical Cuban fashion, they're starting with education to build collaboration over a long-term period. And I suspect that China and India are going to be a far greater players because the West has been so meagerly slow in cooperating with the Chinese, the Cuban science developments, apart from the wonderful examples that we've heard from the panel. Those are just small initiatives. They go for the big picture as well, and I suspect we'll see that most of the Cuban developments will be manufactured and produced in China.
Is there one last quick question? Please.
I was going to ask about other examples of U.S.-Cuba market collaboration. I know, for example, that the GlaxoSmithKline got permission from OFAC to do clinical trials of the pediatric meningitis B vaccine and gave it up after a few years because the licensing restrictions from OFAC were so onerous, and that the cancer vaccines, the head of the John Wayne Hospital, the John Wayne Oncology Unit in Southern California, had lobbied Congress for years and got permission to do clinical trials of the cancer vaccine in California until the company they were using to do the business went bankrupt and that deal ended. Are any of you aware of other efforts to make collaborations between U.S. partners and Cuban partners in marketing any of these products or doing more clinical trials of the Cuban products in the United States?
In terms of the cancer vaccine and specifically the monoclonal antibody, all the trials and the marketing in the US is being done through a company based in Canada, which is YM Biosciences.
Maybe I could just add a little sidelight. This was an idea that sort of went nowhere, I think, but it's an example of how difficult sometimes communication and attitudes can be. But there was a little bit of an effort, well, there still is a little effort at my university to broaden the degree of interaction and research collaborations with Cuba. And there was a group of faculty that visited Cuba to see some of these institutes a couple of years ago. And I was asked to meet with one gentleman in the medical school who was going with that group. And he was most sincere and enthusiastic and really wanted to go find out what he could find out. But his idea was he had some relationships with a company in this country, and he had decided that Cuba would be an ideal site to do a clinical trial, and he wanted to go there and set up to do a clinical trial in Cuba of a U.S. drug. And I attempted not to totally discourage him, but I said, you know, I don't really think that this is something that on first meeting they're going to say, sure, bring your drug in here and give it to our people. You know, it's a little, sometimes the building of these interpersonal relationships and understanding each other's system from both sides is a real prerequisite to making any progress.
Well, with that, I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking our panelists for a wonderful presentation. It's a really interesting topic. I encourage you to speak with them after.